So, welcome to, what is this, the fifth lecture now? Fifth seminar, I should say, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And you're all here familiar with our website. It's cepr.net. And you can find more information on all of this on our website. And so, I won't spend any more time introducing. I want to talk about trade today, because obviously it's a huge topic. It's in the news quite a bit. You know, it wasn't really until NAFTA, really, trade agreements. And I don't even like to call them trade agreements. I usually call them commercial agreements, because the WTO, for example, its most important, economically important elements are not the trade parts of it. The trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, or the TRIPS agreement, is economically more important than the tariff barrier reductions, probably. And so they're not really just even trade agreements, and they're certainly not free trade agreements. And some of my friends from south of the border would argue they're not really even agreements, because they feel they're forced down their throats. But nonetheless, we're talking about trade, and we're talking about some of the related topics. And as I was starting to say, really wasn't until NAFTA that you had any public awareness. These things used to be just, you know, buried in the business section. People who were really interested in the subject read about it, maybe. And that was it. And then now, in the last 10 years, they have become issues. So what I want to do here is just clear up some of the issues so that people can have a better understanding of what we're really dealing with in these debates over the WTO, NAFTA, the Andean Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, whatever we're going to be talking about in the next year or more. And I want to start by looking at, I want to help people understand what the editorialists, the newspapers, the Washington Post, when they're talking about the gains from trade, let's start with that and see what are they really talking about according to economists. So there's a standard argument for liberalizing trade. And it goes back to David Ricardo. It goes back before that, but he's the one most famously associated with 1817. And it's called the theory of comparative advantage. And basically what he showed was that countries can gain from specialization and trade even when one country is more productive than the other at everything. And it wasn't immediately intuitive, right? If you think if one country can produce everything more efficiently than its potential trading partner, then why would it need to trade? And so he showed that, in fact, both countries could gain, even if that were true. And that's why it's called comparative advantage, because one country has a comparative advantage, generally, in something. And so here was Ricardo's example from the 19th century. And you have two countries, England and Portugal, and they're producing two goods, wine and cloth. And it's Ricardo had a labor theory of value, and so he was really just looking at the labor requirements here, the classical economist. So didn't really introduce the kind of models that we see today. And so you have basically in this chart, you can see it takes 120 people a year to produce a unit, some unit, a barrel, in Ricardo's text, of wine. He didn't say people, he said men, but that was really 19th century. And then it takes them 100, takes 100 of them, 100 people to produce a unit of cloth. And in Portugal, the respective amounts are 80 and 90. So you can see that Portugal is more efficient in both branches of production. And so the question is, why would both countries gain from trade? So Ricardo said, well, you can see there's a relative advantage, or what we call comparative advantage, for Portugal in wine. And you can see this by just comparing. It's relatively more efficient. 80 over 120 is less than 90 over 100. So they're relatively, even though they're more efficient in both, they're relatively more efficient in the production of wine. And by the same margin, by the same logic, England would have a comparative advantage in producing cloth. And so you can show that both can gain from specialization and trade. And the idea is, you know, one way to show this is you have Portugal give up one unit of cloth, and we can go back to the previous graph for a second. So you see they give up one unit of cloth, and so they can then produce 90 over 80, or 1.125 units of wine. So you have that extra wine in the world. And now you have England add one unit of cloth, so you have the same amount of cloth that you had before. And they only have to give up 0.833 units of wine. And so you have more wine. Everybody's drinking more wine. Everybody's happier. Especially, we're going to have wine at the break, I think, as well. So, to go with this example, although we won't have any cloth for you. And you have to bring your own clothing. But the idea is that consumers benefit. You get international prices adjust. So there's some new prices that are different from what the prices would have been based on the labor requirements under autarky, that is, before trade. And there's some gains for the world to share. And they would be shared according to, depending on where the price ultimately settled. And to show that, we would have to introduce the consumer's preferences. And, of course, if this were a class in international economics that I was teaching, we would spend at least a couple of weeks on this, introducing both the graphs of this model, and then you introduce capital, and you get slightly in consumer's preferences, you get more complicated graphs, and you can go on for quite a long time. If it's a graduate course, you can go on for many weeks with matrix algebra and other ways of complicating the model. But I'm not sure that it changes all that much in terms of the basic understanding of these efficiency gains. What basically is going on here is you had a barrier to trade, and by removing that, you're allowing more efficient production to take place. That's what's really going on here. And as a result, you get more production and the gains are shared. And that's really what, when you hear people arguing for removing trade barriers, they're really making that argument. Now, there's a modern version of it, but it isn't drastically different. And we'll see when we look in more detail. Now, there's a lot of things you have to keep in mind. I mean, this is true. There are efficiency gains from trade. But there's a lot of things you have to ignore for the moment, or actually you shouldn't ignore it, but we are ignoring it for the moment. So, first of all, the model assumes that there's full employment. And we'll see that's a big deal, right? If the WTO is going to implement its agreement on agriculture, there's a lot of countries where the majority of the population, or some countries at least, where the majority of population is still in agriculture. And if they get displaced, they're not necessarily going to find other jobs. So not only them, but the entire country could be worse off as a result of a trade opening if you don't assume that everybody displaced through trade opening finds another job. We'll get to that too. It ignores what happens to distribution because economists don't ignore this second point of distribution completely, but anybody who's making the pure argument that trade liberalization is benefit for everyone is ignoring the distribution. And typically what people say, well, and what economists say, is that there's enough gains there so that you can redistribute within the country and you can therefore make everyone better off. And that is theoretically true, but it almost never happens in practice. In practice, what happens is some people lose and others gain as a result of trade. And a third point is that this is a very static theory, right? It's just looking at the particular moment in time. It says, well, you should specialize according to your comparative advantage if you're a developing country, and then trade. And, of course, you know, this is kind of like telling somebody who just graduated high school that they should work at McDonald's for the rest of their lives because that's the only job they can get. You know, the idea is to acquire new skills and education, perhaps, and move into something where you have higher productivity and presumably a higher wage. And that's what countries want to do, too. They want to, the whole idea of development is to change your comparative advantage. And if you think I'm oversimplifying, there were pretty high-level economists, including Nobel Prize winners after World War II, that told Japan that they wouldn't have a they would never really be a big industrial producer because they didn't have iron ore and they didn't have a lot of wood and they weren't set for steel production and things like that. And fortunately for the Japanese people, they didn't take that advice. And while they may have specialized to in their comparative advantage for a little bit, they were constantly moving up the ladder by, you know, which required enormous intervention by the government. And so that's a really big thing, and always to keep in mind that comparative advantage is, it's useful advice for a particular moment in time, but it doesn't really tell you how to become a developed country, or even if you're a developed country, how to increase your national income over time. And there are a lot of other problems with the other caveats that I would put in there, but we won't probably have time to discuss them. The theory doesn't do that well when you try to extend it to a lot of countries and a lot of goods and multiple factor production factors of production all at once. There are other you know, things that will come up as well. One thing to note here is that the gains from trade come from the import side. That's how you gain from trade. And this may seem paradoxical because if you look at the trade negotiations, the WTO, everybody's fighting over access to export markets, for example. And it's always, you know, people, countries don't want to open up. Whereas the economists would tell them that that's actually a gift to you, right? To open up your economy and be able to take advantage of the higher efficiency production in other countries is actually what you want to do. And that's pretty important because it shows there is a certain disconnect between trade theory and the world. But nonetheless, there is some truth to this as well. There are real efficiency gains from trade. Now, the problem is that they're, for the developing countries, they're often grossly exaggerated. And you see a lot of, you know, when you read the papers about the WTO negotiations, it always, all the articles I read act as though or write as though this would, if these negotiations collapsed, that, you know, the world would sink into some kind of morass of poverty. And but when you actually look at the studies that economists do to look at the gains, try and measure these efficiency gains that we just talked about, they turn out to be relatively small. Here's one example I like to use just from the World Bank research. Say you got rid of all the barriers that the rich countries now have to low and middle income countries for all of their merchandise trade, and the subsidies too. We got rid of those as well. So tariffs, quotas, everything. They could get sell anything they want, the low and middle income countries. What would they really gain? And the World Bank study shows for the standard efficiency gains, it doesn't come out to very much. By 2015, you get an extra 0.6% of GDP. That's from the liberalization, if it were all to take place through the Uruguay round of the GATT that created the WTO. That's what they end up with. And this isn't a lot. You know, a country with $1,000 a year of per capita income would thus have $1,006 per person 10 years from now. And they would have that indefinitely, but still, it's not a lot. Considering how much we're led to believe that these gains are quite enormous. So standard economic models just don't show really big gains from trade liberalization. And there's some reasons for that. First of all, yeah, and some of the countries actually lose, right? So from textiles and agriculture, you have a lot of countries that actually lose from trade liberalization. And I'll explain that in a minute. Well, I guess my PowerPoint says I'll explain it right now. so I better do that. I've never used PowerPoint when I talk because, it tells you what you're supposed to say, and I don't really like that. But it is there, and it makes it easier for you, right? Okay, so some countries are going to be hurt because you have quota elimination. So we have a sugar quota in the U.S., right? So if we eliminate that quota, well, there's gains to U.S. consumers, and there's going to be gains to some countries that couldn't get in under the quota right now. But the countries that are part of the quota that actually can export to the United States, they have an allocation from the current quota. They're getting 2.5 times the world price. So they're going to lose. So that has to be factored in. And the standard economic models take that into account. And by the way, we saw the result of that, right? I mean, with the elimination at the beginning of this year of the textile and apparel quotas, you might have seen some of the stories about the loss of jobs in a lot of countries that were able to produce and for U.S. and European markets because of the quotas, and now they get outcompeted by China. It's still going on, but it's still it's a loss. So does everybody understand that? You know, when a quota raises the price for these producers, okay. Another effect when you liberalize trade is the relative prices change. So you might be exporting semiconductors and those prices go down and the prices of your imports go up, in which case you lose as a country as a result of that. And finally, this is not trivial either. I mean, the majority of the poorest countries in the world are net importers of food. And so they're gaining from the subsidies that everybody's trying to get rid of. When they get rid of them, a lot of countries are going to have pay a lot more for food because they're getting subsidized food now. So this is one reason, you know, for instance, I would argue they should just be able to put up, the countries that don't want the subsidized food should just be able to put up a tariff or other barriers to it, and the ones that want it should be able to keep it rather than trying to apply a general rule that doesn't necessarily fit everyone. Okay, now, the other side of it is there are costs from trade liberalization that are not really taken into account when you read these editorials that say how much the world is going to gain. And, you know, I think the first lecture talked about putting numbers in context, and we'll do a little more of that too. But notice I gave you that number, 0.6% of world GDP. Now, if world GDP is, 30, I think it's something like 30 trillion now, and it's probably more than that, 36 trillion, and what will it be in 2015? You can make that sound like an awful lot, a very big number, and that's sometimes what you see in the papers. You see very big numbers, but we're putting them in context so that you understand these are not huge gains. So you have other reasons why developing countries might not be that excited about immediately lifting their barriers. One is they depend, a lot of them, for their revenue to finance their government. They depend on tariffs. And that's because, a lot of them don't have, like, the equivalent of the IRS in the United States, which has, in recent years, been having more and more trouble collecting taxes from rich people. I mean, imagine if you have, a tiny 100th, 1,000th of the resources that they have, and you're trying to collect taxes from rich people, you don't get it. So you can at least collect taxes at the border for goods. And so this is a big thing because for several reasons. One reason is they need the revenue. Two is, even assuming they could raise the revenue in other ways, there are going to be distortions and inefficiencies associated with that tax revenue, just like a tariff. And so we're not even clear how much better off they are because economists don't seem to take that into account, which I think that is a very bad mistake. That is, they always just say, standard economic models, they say, well, we got rid of the tariff, great, you have all these efficiency gains, wonderful. But then they say, what do you have to do to get the tariff revenue back? You impose what they call a lump sum tax, a tax which comes out of nowhere, essentially, doesn't produce any distortions because it's not an income tax, it's not a sales tax, it's just a fictional lump sum tax. Whereas in the real world, all taxes have distortions just like tariffs do. So that's an important point. That was one of the caveats that I didn't have time to get to. The second one, if tariffs are reduced, second point, or eliminated, countries have to increase these other taxes, and a lot of times they can't even do it, you know. And so what is going to happen? They're going to cut social services, essential spending, we don't even know. The third point is the one I alluded to a little earlier on agriculture. If you have, you know, so many of your people, majority of people in some 40% in some countries, countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan, it's close to a majority. What are you going to do when you're opened up to competition from the mechanized, even if it's not subsidies, subsidized agriculture? And that's a really good point, you know, because people are, it's an important point, people are obsessed often with the subsidies, but if you took away all the subsidies of U.S. agriculture, it would still wipe out most of the small farmers in the world because it's just more productive because of the mechanization and everything else and the land we have and the inputs. And do we want that kind of competition? That's more fair than having subsidies, but and sure, some of the big, efficient, most efficient producers of grains like Brazil and Argentina, they'd be able to compete. But what about all the small farmers, the hundreds of millions of people all over the world? You know, we went from, you know, 1870 in the United States, we had 53% of our population in agriculture. And by 100 years later, it was 4.6%. Okay, and that we had a lot of social unrest along the way, and that was 100 years. Now, try making those changes in the period of 10 or 15 years, or even less, which is what a lot of the negotiators in the WTO believe is feasible, and a lot of economists believe would actually be good, and you're talking about possible social explosions. Now, what are other costs? This is a huge one. The TRIPS agreement, which I mentioned, and the actual, if you now, this by the way shows how the whole debate has been misunderstood, because WTO was agreed upon in 1994-95 and ratified in 95, and you know, nobody really even talked about it. There were no estimates of what this would cost for countries to enforce U.S. style patent and copyright laws. These are enormous costs, so nobody even bothered to look at it. It's only recently the World Bank has even published any numbers at all, which we were able to use here, and they're very preliminary, and they weren't taken very seriously even as a cost. But these costs turned out to be enormous, so we'll look at that quantitatively in a minute. But there's another big cost that countries have also endured over the last 20, 25 years, 30 years even. And that's increasing reserves. If you have more trade, you have to have more international currency reserves and other international reserves. They don't always, obviously, they don't hold currency. They hold U.S. treasuries and all kinds of other dollar-denominated or hard currency-denominated assets. But it's the same thing. The return to these is very low. So a country that's holding, you know, U.S. treasuries, getting a real interest rate about 1% right now, and that money could be invested in their economy at a return of 10% or even more, in a lot of, you know, up to 20% in a lot of cases. And so that's a big cost, and we measured that as well. And we'll come back to the quantitative comparison in a minute. First, I just want to go through these losses. These are losses to trade liberalization in agriculture to various countries, according to Standard General Equilibrium Model by Deardorff, Brown, and Stern, very pro-trade economists, but nonetheless, that's what their model comes out to, pro-WTO economists, I should say. Their model comes out, shows losses. These are significant. Indonesia and the Philippines, those are over 1% of GDP. That would be, you know, what, over 120 billion a year for us. And these are losses due to liberalization in agriculture. Now, let's compare the gains let's take a look, first of all, at the gains to developing countries. As I said at the beginning, from the World Bank study, you get a gain for the developing countries, the low and middle income countries, the gain from opening up all of our countries, rich country markets to them. That's what we're looking at on the left-hand side. And that's eliminating all the barriers and subsidies in rich countries. You have a gain of about 0.6% of 1% of GDP, which I mentioned earlier. Now, on the import side, you have more, almost twice as much, about 1.1. So there you have, you know, it's more significant. You add them together on the right, you get 1.7, which is getting closer to something that's more significant. Still not a huge amount, but something significant. But notice, the import side, you don't need the WTO or any trade agreements or bilateral trade agreements or anything for that, right? That is, any country can eliminate its trade barriers anytime it wants to. Now, you could take the attitude, which people here do say off the record a lot, in Washington, that we have to force these countries to do what's good for them. But that's not a very compelling argument to make in public in Geneva or in Hong Kong at the WTO ministerial, and I would reject it out of hand. So I wouldn't put those gains in the same category as the left-hand side. In other words, the gains from opening up removing your own barriers, that's something for individual countries that they should just be able to decide. And it's hard to argue that we need these agreements in order to force them to do this. So anyway, that gives you the total amount. That, again, this is based on the Uruguay round of the GATT, which created the WTO. Now, here's a good way to put them in perspective. From a policy point of view, if we're really trying to promote development here and not just the interest of particular corporations or a certain ideology that says trade is an end in itself, which is we often see in the press here, you know. Look at this comparing various growth rates and over the last 40 years. And here we have on the left a story of a successful growth experience. South Korea went from, you know, being at the level of income of Ghana in per capita income in 1960 to now European per capita income. And, you know, average of 6.1% a year annual growth. And here's Latin America, and what would their, again, rate of growth be without trade liberalization based on the past? And you can see it a little over 2%. And you're really going to need your glasses to see the difference between that second bar from the left, and what would happen if they liberalized, you know, if we had liberalized trade. You see, it isn't drastically different. And the same is true for sub-Saharan Africa. So we're really talking about a difference. Again, this is based on the period 2000 to 2010. And there isn't that much of a difference from trade liberalization. And the reason I put this in here is because I think that economists really ought to be spending a lot more time trying to figure out, you know, what were the basis of successful growth experiences and maybe try and draw some lessons from those rather than from the abstract theory that I started with at the beginning, that there are gains from trade liberalization. Okay, here's something I want to emphasize, and this is a major theme here at CEPR. When we say trade, we're not talking about free trade. Okay, and this is not a rhetorical point. I want people to try and understand this as an economic point. So, in other words, if you look at that argument that you saw, Ricardo's argument, for liberalizing trade, and you multiply that times 50 or 100, that's the kind of argument you have for liberalizing trade in pharmaceutical goods, that is, getting rid of patents, okay, copyrights. And those arguments, now again, we're not saying that patents or copyrights are going to be abolished tomorrow or anything like that, but either are trade barriers, right? Economists have been very practical about that, saying, well, let's see what progress we can make. You know, they spent the last 40 years in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, you know, reducing barriers. Well, here are items where the gains, the efficiency gains that we talked about, are much, much bigger, many times bigger than the gains from liberalizing merchandise trade. And yet, the WTO agreement and the bilateral agreements and the NAFTA and the proposed FTAA are all going in the opposite direction in these agreements. They're all saying, no, we actually have to increase protection in these areas of intellectual property. So, in other words, there's something really wrong here. And I think what's wrong, it's not that hard to figure out if you look at it in political terms. In merchandise trade, you're pushing down through competition, you're introducing international competition to push down the wages of manufacturing workers, and not just manufacturing workers, as you'll see in the United States, and you saw from previous seminar, it's been, you know, the bottom three quarters of the labor force has lost enormous ground over the last 30 years. And so you're liberalizing trade in those areas where the people who suffer the consequences have very little voice in politics. And you're actually increasing protectionism in the areas of patents, copyrights, where the profit goes to very powerful corporations, such as the pharmaceutical corporations, the protectionism. And also we'll see professionals as well. So this is the first one I wanted to point out, and that's just the increase in protection for copyrights and patents in the TRIPS agreement, which forces countries, the signers, the 148 signers of the WTO, to adopt patent and copyright laws that would protect these goods. Now, the second one is, second point is just one I already made. The third point is the gains in liberalization in professional services. And those are very large as well compared to the gains in merchandise trade. For example, we estimated that if you just increased the supply, you had a reduction in barriers to professional services. So in other words, we have all these barriers, which Dean is going to talk about later, in professional services, for doctors, dentists, lawyers, accountants, economists. And if you removed, you don't have to remove those barriers entirely, but if you just had a modest increase in supply, say 15%, the gains from that would range from 160 to 270 billion a year. Okay, now you compare that to getting rid of steel tariffs. That's 3 billion. Okay, so these are the big gains. Okay, the gains in the intellectual property protected goods, the gains in protected professional services, those are where the real big gains from trade liberalization are, and you don't see any big push for them. And why? Again, the professional classes in the United States have much more political clout than the three quarters of the labor force that doesn't have a college degree. That's really what you're talking about. Now, I really want to emphasize, it's not because, you know, so people will be even more cynical than they are about politics, but I think there's actually a potential here to change the debate, because I don't think most of the journalists even writing about this, for example, understand this concept, that when they're writing about gains from trade, they're writing about gains that are relatively small compared to the other trade gains, efficiency gains, that are every bit as feasible. And in fact, most of them could be done with much less effort and less cost even than the negotiations at the WTO. So these are, because they just haven't thought of it in these terms. And also they may not, a lot of people don't understand the concept of an efficiency gain or a deadweight loss, which let's take a look at in a second here. Oh, yes, good. It's the next one. I didn't know it was coming. Go ahead. Yes. The question was, what does it mean to liberalize? Yes, you would have 15% more doctors, dentists, lawyers, and accountants from foreign countries. And you would license them and do all the things that are necessary to make sure that they meet all the quality standards that we have here in the United States. And it would, as I said, it could be done with probably less effort than we've had to do for a lot of our goods and services trade. And so this is what we're talking about. And here's an example. Okay, I won't have time to go into all the details here. So don't look at the graph for a second. It's the other thing I don't like about PowerPoint. Everybody reads the text, looks at the graph, and sometimes they have to listen. Okay. So what do we mean by a deadweight loss? What Ricardo was talking about in the 19th century has been refined through economic theory over the last, 100 and, it's almost 200 years now. But the concept is similar. Now economists would say they're talking about allocative efficiency. That's the concept. So they're saying in competitive markets, prices are driven down to the marginal cost of production. That is the cost of producing one more unit. Okay? So, for example, this microphone, let's say it costs, I really don't have a good idea, $50 to produce. And let's say that you have $50 and you want one of these, and you're willing to pay what it costs to produce, including a profit included, a normal rate of return included in the price. And you'd be willing to pay that, but you can't get it because of some monopoly, either a tariff or a domestic monopoly, or anything else that raises the price to, say, 75 or something out of your range. Okay, then you're suffering what's called, that's the efficiency loss, and it's called a deadweight loss because that loss is above and beyond what's redistributed when somebody else pays $75 and the monopolist gets, an extra profit. Okay, there's a loss to you, the consumer, that is in addition to any redistributive effect. Those are the efficiency losses. Those are the same thing that Ricardo identified because of trade barriers, and it's the same thing that we have when you have a monopoly due to a patent, a monopoly due to a tariff, a monopoly due to a quota. For economists, they're all the same thing. Okay? So that's why they're so big in the case of patents and copyrights, because, look at the extreme case, the AIDS drugs, which cost now $150 a year to produce. They sell for $8,000 a year in the United States. The antiretroviral drugs, they used to sell for $12,000. And you had this enormous struggle that took years for people, and it's still going on, for people to have access to these drugs. This is the extreme case. It's actually the most costly form of protectionism in the entire world. Is in these essential medicines. And again, in the future seminars, we're going to talk about some of the details of that. But I just wanted, for this comparison, so you understand what we're talking about and what the Washington Post is talking about when they talk about the benefits of free trade. Look at this. This is a deadweight loss. This is the loss to consumers, as economists typically measure it, from having a $2 tariff on a $20 shirt, a 10% tariff, which is in the range of a fairly sizable tariff, and you go to the deadweight loss to consumers due to a copyright on some software, for example, and it's just enormously bigger. That's why these losses from protectionism and intellectual property come out to be so much bigger, because the loss to consumers, the deadweight loss that we're talking about, is proportional to the difference between the price that the product sells at and its marginal cost. It's actually the square of the difference. But the point is, the bigger that difference is, the bigger the loss to consumers. So the free traders, the people who call themselves free traders, they really ought to be out there talking about, and some of them are. I mean, some of them do say it. Jagdish Bhagwati at Columbia University, one of our most famous international economists, he says that TRIPS doesn't belong in the WTO, right? It's because it's an opposite concept. It's the WTO is supposedly promoting efficiency through removing barriers to trade, and here were erecting the most costly of barriers through this TRIPS agreement. Go ahead. That's just the quantity of how much of it is sold, how much of the patented software is sold. So it's a standard demand curve, price on the vertical axis and quantity on the horizontal axis. Go ahead. No, that's a, you know, you still have to, I mean, it's an important point. You still have to, there has to be some way to pay the, cover the research and development costs. And the, right now we cover it by granting a, in a very inefficient way, by granting a patent or a copyright monopoly, which causes all these losses to society, as well as the massive redistribution income and all the waste, you know, the pharmaceutical companies suing each other, getting, producing, you know, most of their research goes into copycat drugs and all the other things. Now, the other way to fund it, of course, is well, there are a lot of alternatives, but one is that what we already have for half of the biomedical research in the United States is already funded through the NIH and nonprofit sector and universities and everywhere else. So the marginal cost is not going to cover the overall, all the research and development costs, but what it, but the idea is from an economic point of view, you want that price to be as close to the marginal cost as you can get it and still have the incentives that you need to produce the good. Okay. Now, since we're in the United States, I wanted to make sure I left some time to talk about trade and impacts in the United States. And this is a graph from John's previous seminar, looking at what's happened to income distribution from 1947 to 2003. And the big change, of course, is the last 30 years there, from around mid-70s, 1973 to 2003. You see a huge break with the trend. This is the median, real median family income. It would look worse if we looked at the wage, because you have increased labor force participation during this time. But it still looks bad enough. So what has happened here? What's happened is you've had an enormous split between, you know, wages used to grow roughly and normally do grow in line with productivity. In other words, output per hour increases, workers get their share of that, right? And the what happened in the last 30 years is that this diverged. We've had 80% increase in productivity in the last three decades, and the median wage has gone up by about 9%, okay, which is just drastic. I mean, you know, and for the few people here who are old enough to remember the, you know, 50s or 60s or 70s, you know, it wasn't that uncommon for somebody with the typical wage to buy a house on one income and raise a family and send their kids to college. And, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. And that's partly because of this drastic change in income distribution. Another one of these issues that hasn't been getting the proper attention that it deserves in the media and policy circles. And now the question is, well, how much does trade have to do with that? And that's a matter of debate among economists. You know, you have estimates. Some economists say nothing. And other estimates, even by very pro-trade, and I would say not just pro-trade, but pro-WTO, pro-NAFTA, et cetera, economists go all the way up to 39% of this wage inequality has as a result of trade. And I think it's definitely a lot. I think we don't know how much. But the point is, it doesn't really have to be that much to outweigh the gains from trade. In other words, the gains from trade are not that large, so that even if a small fraction of the increase in inequality that has resulted in the last 30 years comes from trade, then it would be a net loss for the majority of the labor force, in fact, the three-quarters of the labor force that doesn't have a college degree. It's pretty safe to say, I would say, that they lost the losses that they suffered from their wages not growing over time, as they always used to, far outweighs, or at least outweighs, the gains that they might have from access to cheaper consumer goods, DVD players or whatever. And again, you can see that if you look around you and if you've lived long enough, it's not that surprising. A couple of ways that it happens, right? You have between 79 and 99, there were over 6.4 million manufacturing jobs, conservative estimate, were lost in trade competing industries. Now, for that to have no impact on income distribution, all those people or all the new jobs that were created that replaced those jobs would have to pay as much as the ones that were lost, and we know that that didn't happen. So clearly that's one way in which it's very obvious that trade contributed to the increasing inequality. And by the way, this is huge. You know, I couldn't read it exactly off that last graph because that graph shows a trend line that's based on the growth rate from 1947 to 73, but growth also slowed down, not drastically. But just if, you know, if wages had just kept up with productivity in the productivity growth, if the median wage had kept up with productivity growth in the last 30 years, the way it did in the previous period, before we had these structural changes, the typical family, instead of roughly $44,000 median income today, would have way over $60,000. So you're talking about a big difference in living standards, again, for the majority of the population. And I think it's really only because people don't know about it that it's not the number one political issue in every national election campaign. People don't have they don't know these statistics, and they don't really have, the media hasn't presented to them a story that would explain how much worse off they are than what was feasible, right? What was reasonable, not some utopian world in which everything worked the way it was supposed to, just based on what always happened or generally happened in the economic history in the United States, where, again, wages would grow over a long period of time, at least, with productivity. So there's other things, too. Before we get to the last point, you know, when I say trade, I'm even just talking about trade. We're not talking about the other effects of reduced bargaining power for workers. So in the majority of union organization drives, for example, Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell found that employers use threats to move. And it was even more than that, 68% in mobile industries like manufacturing. So this is a very important part of the story that's not captured in most of the studies looking at the effects of trade on wage inequality. So, again, we've had, and there are other ones as well, but I think it's pretty clear that it's a significant part of the story, and again, more than enough to outweigh the gains from trade as economists measure them for the vast majority of people in the United States. Okay, finally, I want to put this in here because it's part of the agenda, and I'm not too far over time. The because I don't think this has gotten enough attention. And that's one of the reasons I emphasize wage, by the way. In the big trade debates, when you do see the issue raised, people usually emphasize jobs. But the bigger impact on people of trade has actually been through wages, the downward pressure on wages, because it affects so many more people over such a long period of time. Now, another impact that people haven't looked at is the dollar. And the dollar is overvalued right now. Now, how do we know that? Well, one way of knowing that is that we're running a trade deficit of over 6% of our national income each year. Now, that means we're borrowing from the rest of the world because we're importing more than we're exporting to the amount of over 6% of our income. Now, we can do that for a while, but we can't do that indefinitely. So, you know, 14 years from now or so, 15 years from now, we'll have a, if we just stay at this pace, not even growing, but just stay at this pace of borrowing, you know, we'll have a foreign debt that's around the size of our entire value of our stock market, for example. That's not going to happen, okay? So what happens? Well, in a flexible exchange rate system, which is what we have for the dollar falls. And when the dollar falls, our imports become more expensive and our export becomes cheaper, and that's how the trade gap narrows and doesn't have to disappear at all. In fact, it's not going to probably for a long, long time, but it has to be reduced to a level that is sustainable, that isn't explosive over some foreseeable period of time. And so that is going to happen. So on that basis, which, and this is, I think almost all economists agree on that now, the dollar is very overvalued. Now, what isn't talked about enough is what's the impact of that. And that's why I put it here on this slide. I think it's the last one. If the dollar is 25% overvalued, that's the same thing as having a tariff of 25% on all the exports that we send to other countries, and having a subsidy of 20%, because it's not exactly symmetrical, to the countries that are exporting anything to the United States. That's the impact. So you can imagine why we've lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs since 2000. This is a huge part of the picture, and one that hasn't really gotten as much attention as it should. Some of the reasons, I guess, why don't I give you, I want to make sure I give people enough for time for question and answer. So if people have questions about that, they can raise that, and I'll just stop here.